Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
I'm Priya Menon, joining you from India, and this is CureTalks 126th episode. Today we are discussing living well with prostate cancer. Our prostate cancer talks are conducted in association with Prostate Cancer International and the Prostate Cancer Foundation. The Prostate Cancer Panel is led by Mike Scott, co-founder and president of Prostate Cancer International. Joining Mike are prostate cancer advocates Tony Crispino and Paul Carpenter. Our featured expert today is eminent prostate cancer expert, Dr. Paul Shellhammer. We continue our discussion with Dr. Shellhammer on prostate cancer and life thereafter. Today's discussion will address how patients, advocates, and caregivers can help the medical community develop new data that will provide better information on how to help patients live well with prostate cancer. Welcome to CureTalks, everyone. It's a pleasure to have you here. We will be addressing questions towards the end of the discussion. Listeners can press 1 on their keypads to let us know if they have a question to ask, and we will bring them on air. They may also email the question to priya@trialx.com or post them on curetalks.com. With that, I will now hand over to Mike to begin with the discussion. Mike, you're on.
Thank you, Priya. So good evening, everyone. And one of the things we wanted to continue doing in our discussion this evening was to look at the degree to which there is real evidence about the survival benefits of different aspects of living with prostate cancer as opposed to its actual treatment with drugs and with surgery and with radiation therapy. There has been a good deal of information available over the years about things like diet and exercise, but most of the studies that have been carried out have been retrospective studies. And so there is limited, really concrete information that is available to, for example, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network or to others who write guidelines for physicians that say to them, and therefore to their patients, you really need to do X or Y in order to optimize the quality of your life. And so one of the things I think we'd like to discuss this evening is whether there is going to be more information like that as we move further forward in the research into prostate cancer, and whether there is actually a willingness on the part of all concerned to really include this sort of information in the guidelines about treatment and management of prostate cancer. And what I'd like to do at this point is have Tony Crispino tell us a little bit about what's come out in the latest prostate cancer treatment guidelines, where he was helpful in introducing at least one principle related to quality of life in these guidelines. So, Tony, could you tell us a little about that?
I certainly can. First, it was an exciting endeavor to be a part of that guideline panel in the first place. But when we're talking about putting together guidelines, we're getting all kinds of good data on treatment types, and very little data on things such as men's health as far as diet, exercise, which are all common sense, because as I always say when I do public speaking, what's a healthy prostate diet? And I always say it's a heart healthy diet, because that's probably what's more likely to kill you than prostate cancer anyway. We don't see a lot of paperwork out there, though. I've seen a couple of trials attempted. The MEAL trial is out there still trying to recruit, and it is specifically coaching patients on how to eat properly versus give them no information and compare down the road. I'm not sure when we're going to see any results off of those trials. I don't think it's going to happen in the next 10 years. I think that it's common sense that when you eat well, your body fights disease better. You certainly feel better. It helps quality of life. And I think that it really needs to be in guidelines moving forward to make a mention. Right now, if you ever hear anything, if a guy ever hears anything about it, he hears it mostly if they've been put on hormone therapy to exercise to try to counter the effects of hormone therapy. but clearly it's something that should be given as an instructional kind of aid to anybody who's diagnosed, whether they're on active surveillance, going through localized therapy, on systemic therapy. It's just common sense, and I don't see enough of it out there.
So, Dr. Shellhammer, as somebody who's obviously been involved in the writing of guidelines often over the years, what do you think we need to get this sort of information into the guidelines? As you and I discussed earlier today, there are some studies coming out of Australia related to exercise particularly. We do have good level 3 and 4 data suggesting that exercise and diet are important, but none of this has got into guidelines at all yet. And as I think I also mentioned to you, there was a recent study suggesting that 80% of medical oncologists are very reluctant to talk about these issues with their patients when it comes to prostate cancer, which seems rather sad to me.
Yes, well, I think some of the problem is the referring to that amazing statistic with regard to lack of enthusiasm, there's lack of knowledge and education about diet and exercise and, we'll say, lifestyle issues versus pharmacologic agents and for surgeons, urologists, surgical interventions. So, I mean, speaking for myself, I went to medical school in the 1960s, which was a long time ago, but nary a bit of education or instruction in diet and lifestyle. And I think it's more so now, but still takes very much second place to, we'll say, the traditional medical interventions of pharmacologic agents and surgical procedures. Actually, patients are more aware, perhaps, or more interested in gaining that information, because I'll say that more often than not, they will ask me, well, what can I do about diet, exercise, et cetera, looking for specifics. Well, I provide generalities and maybe a bit more specifics now, but nothing that parallels the ability to go to a number of studies with regard to drug A versus drug B or procedure A versus B. So there's been a hole, a deficit, and I'm not wildly optimistic that it's going to change dramatically until there's some real impetus in education, in reimbursement, in, I'll say, folks dedicated to the subspecialty of wellness beyond therapies.
Do you actually refer patients, for example, to physical therapy experts or nutritionists often?
We in our large urology group have just started a specific referral pathway for physical therapy amongst individuals starting androgen deprivation therapy, but not pre-surgery, other than perhaps dealing with radical prostatectomy, dealing with incontinence issues, but not dealing necessarily with overall bodily health. And certainly with regard to nutrition, if someone is markedly overweight, there's the mantra to exercise and lose X number of pounds, but it's more of a admonition than a pathway to success. And on the other hand, if someone has lost a significant amount of weight and is obviously debilitated, there's the effort to increase food intake and protein and so forth to better tolerate surgery, but that's usually in other cancers like bladder cancer, prostate cancer, that's a rarity it's more the overweight person. But an answer, direct answer to your question, only physical therapy for ADT folks, and that's just recent, whereas you'd think that would have been on the docket for years because we know all of the debilitating circumstances that occur after androgen deprivation therapy, but we're at least making some progress in that direction. But dietary-wise, no, rarely.
So I know that in Canada, Richard Wassersug worked with funding from Movember to develop an educational course that he now gives either live or online to patients who are newly diagnosed and need androgen deprivation therapy for some reason, I mean almost any of the possible reasons, in which he talks through both the things that the patient should be looking out for and potentially expecting. That obviously runs from weight gain to increased levels of fat on the body to erectile dysfunction and you name it. But the point being that it is a course that is actually designed to help the patient expect the things that are going to happen as opposed to being surprised by them and then having to not know how to deal with them. I know he has had considerable uptake for that program in Canada, and we've actually been talking with him about bringing that to the United States. But exercise is clearly a major portion of that when it comes to androgen deprivation therapy. And I'm wondering, Tony and Paul, if you could talk a little bit about what you currently say to patients about this in your support groups.
Well, I just make, as you were speaking, it becomes clear to me that, and the idea about support groups, that these issues done in groups as much as individual instruction makes for a beneficial camaraderie. So in my experience with support groups, if you can get a number of individuals, whether it be 5 or 15, to bounce ideas back and forth and then consolidate a plan, which then the next support group interaction can kind of go over and determine if everybody is on the mark. It's very similar to team training and athleticism. You generally do those things, while there are individual exercises, you do them in a cooperative venture. So one individual supports another, and there's kind of a multiplier effect. So one of the things we don't do, which probably would be helpful, which Wassersug is trying to do, is to get people together who have the same problem to begin a class session that where there's interaction and there are questions that some people want to ask that others may be somewhat reticent to ask, and it kind of brings out the common issues for common discussion as opposed to the concentrated one-on-one, I'll say compressed time where the information may be not one well explained and not well assimilated because of time constraints. So I will say in our large group, we don't do that other than through the support group mechanism that's run by the hospital, but probably it would be very, very advantageous to do so. I'll ask Tony what his experience and thoughts are concerning one-on-one versus one-on-many or many-on-many as far as developing a camaraderie of purpose.
It's an interesting discussion. I've had in our support group several times nutritional coaches come on in and discuss. And they've always been very well received in the group. Whether it's one-on-one or in the group, I don't know that there's a difference, but men are hungry to hear this information. You know, the Society of Integrative Oncology is out there putting together a lot of great paperwork on, you know, how to live well, how to live a, you know, a cancer-free life. And those are always among my best speakers when I can get Dr. Brian Luenda to come on in or any others to come on in and discuss in front of the group. It is always a hit within the group. And very few of the patients in our group have received this counseling from their physician. The primary caring physician for their prostate cancer is not typically the one who's going to crack this information on out. And I think that that's an area with which is an area for improvement within the industry, is for the physicians themselves to, you know, at least make a mention of it. Bring it forward. Let the patient know that there's good ways to eat and there's bad ways to eat, good ways to exercise, bad ways to exercise. But as a whole industry, I think that the urological side, the radiation oncology side, all of them have a good sense of, you know, eating well and staying healthy, but they don't really have a great sense of relaying that information over to their patients, I don't think. It's just my thought.
Paul Carpenter? Paul, are you there? Oh, okay,
hello,
we don't seem to have Paul. Yes,
hello.
I can hear you now.
Okay.
Hi, Paul.
I concur with Tony and everything I just heard him say. The guest lecturers who have information on nutrition, how to eat properly, how to change habits of eating improperly, how to develop a habit of fitness and exercise, those tend to be the most popular speakers. And Tony said it very well. Men are hungry to receive this type of information. I don't know that the proper place to receive it is from a physician. Certainly there needs to be far more than there is. That, as Tony was saying, men don't get this information in any degree of specificity from their physicians. But also there's a larger issue than just eating well to combat prostate cancer or exercising to combat prostate cancer. It's eating well and being fit and being lean to have a good quality of life. One of the one-on-one counseling I always give to men who are facing their first treatments is get fit, get lean. The outcome of whatever treatment you choose is going to be better if you enter into it fit and lean and have already developed those habits.
So I would entirely agree with that. And I think one of the questions I have for everybody is there a role for the prostate cancer advocacy community in trying to push for this type of information to be made more readily available to physicians? I mean, through physicians' offices. I mean, I'm not necessarily suggesting that, you know, this is the most important piece of information that they're going to get when they're diagnosed with prostate cancer. But it does seem to me that we are missing the opportunity often to provide that information on an ongoing basis, even if it's just by handing somebody a brochure that, you know, is about living well with prostate cancer and the things that you can do to help to accomplish that. And it also seems to me there is probably a role for the urology nurse and the oncology nurse in various physicians' offices to help with this. Anybody got any comments about that?
I quite agree. Part of the care for the prostate cancer patient is caring for his self-image and having a body that he feels prouder of is, I think, terribly important in caring for the whole patient. And I would be enthusiastically supportive of the idea of informing the patient how he can become a better person or how his body can become a better body all around, and having that encouraged at the oncologist's or the urologist's office.
Do people see a role? I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
Well, I'm sorry, Mike. I was going to make the comment that physicians with one, the knowledge base and the time constraints probably are not, at least in today's world, the best conveyors of that detailed information. They are the ones that need to obviously direct, push that into the right, we'll say, compartment of education. But nurses, dietitians are probably intellectually, emotionally more involved in delivering that kind of care, sad to say, maybe, but that's more in their bailiwick. And the physician I see as being the one who recognizes it's necessary more and supporting it more than actually being the conveyor of the information.
Oh, I agree with that. I mean, I don't think we can expect physicians to spend a lot of time on this, but if the physician is actually encouraging the patient to see that dietitian or to see that physical therapist, that to me is probably one of the most important things that they can do, along with the rest of the treatment guidance that they're offering.
And I would push back just a little. I would wish for a physician to be able to say, you are approaching diabetes, Mr. Smith. I can prescribe you metformin, but I would much rather have you follow a program of diet and exercise. That way you won't be taking yet another pill for the rest of your life. The diet and exercise are more effective than this pill, and they will last you better and you'll feel better. Or same thing, to a lesser extent, with hot flashes on ADT. And for a physician, for it to come from a physician's lips, where here's a therapy as opposed to here's a lifestyle change. The lifestyle change is probably more effective. It certainly is better for you.
Mm-hmm. Do people see a role for, or rather, I'm sure there is a role. How do people see the roles of patients' partners in helping to increase awareness and increase self-responsibility in this area?
I'll take a shot at that and say it's very, very variable. In some circumstances, tremendously important and supportive. In others, it's not effective because either the significant other is overwhelmed with other issues that it doesn't come into play. So I think it's very individualized and not a general statement can be made. But obviously, if the circumstances and the environment are correct, a tremendous help to the patient if that significant other is on board and understands and is into that kind of mindset and help equation.
And I'd like to add another factor, and that is a sense of mastery, or at least less helplessness, that to become a full active partner in becoming healthy or less unhealthy gives the patient's partner something to do, something to focus on, rather than just waiting anxiously for the next appointment 3 months hence to actually embark upon a course of looking at what the calories are, looking at what the carb count is of these meals, and getting an exercise software that counts the number of steps you take and set goals. So I think there's a very strong role in giving a sense of mastery over the condition rather than acquiescing to it helplessly.
The impression I'm getting is that we have a lot of options that we can often offer people, but that it doesn't necessarily happen very often.
I agree.
And that we still ideally are going to need better data to support the inclusion of this sort of information in guidelines, if that is possible. Tony, is there any way we can persuade organizations like SWOG to look at? I mean, trials of things like diet are obviously very difficult to do because they take a very long time to accomplish. But trials of things like exercise for people on ADT can be done relatively quickly and without huge cost.
Yeah. Over at the SWOG, we have a survivorship committee now. We've recently added that in, and we're just now adding a patient advocate for that as well. But it's absolutely a common discussion in the meetings over at the GU committee over at SWOG, where we're talking about, upcoming possible trials that we'd like to get out on the table. And like I said, the meal trial has been out for several years. And again, it was instructional to the patient to understand how to eat healthy versus a flatline, a standard of care, if you will, of just not coaching them at all. You're right, Mike. These are going to take a long time. They're not real cheap to do. It takes a lot of follow-up. You've got to, with the patients in the meal trial, they actually would get a call a month, asking them how they're doing on their diet and so forth like that. But that kind of follow-up, it's just going to take a long time. And especially when we're talking about, guys who might be healthy enough to be on active surveillance, we don't get results on those kinds of cases for, decades. Not just a decade, but decades. So I would like to point back, though, that there is advocacy out there. There has been strong advocacy out there for some time. Us, too, with their hot sheets and Mark Moyad writing a regular article specifically covering this type of stuff. And
I'm glad you mentioned that, Tony.
Yeah, I've seen him present that many, many times, over a decade at PCRI. And I think that, the groups, the advocates, they do get together. They do discuss it. I think this is the best place for the men to get together. That's why I thought it was a good idea to have a peer statement in the AUA guideline. And this is that opportunity for men to be able to work with each other and talk to each other. And that's probably the best location that they're gonna educate themselves on eating well and staying healthy while they're going through their journey with prostate cancer.
How can an organization like Prostate Cancer or International or us to do a better job of providing that information for people?
Well, I mean, it's got to get out there.
Just to give you an example, we know that the music group up at the University of Michigan and has produced a lot of very useful and relatively straightforward information for people about things that range from the value of exercise through to, the avoidance of hot flashes or the management of hot flashes. But I don't get the impression that the average physician even knows that information is available outside Michigan, for example. And, I mean, a lot of people aren't going to pick up a book like one of the ones that Dr. Moyad produces because they just don't read that much. Their attention span is too short.
I was present when Dr. Moyad gave one of his talks about, if I told you that I could give you a pill that would do this and this and this and this, and it was more effective than this or this, and of course he was leading up to just exercise 30 minutes a day, and it has been shown to produce all these effects. It was a very inspirational talk. I could see that type of information being condensed into just a handout, a three-paragraph handout with the same lead-in and the same hook that could inspire men to understand. Exercise will save my life, and it may do it better and quicker than a pill will.
Yeah, speaking about Mark Moyad, I'm sure he has developed thought about this for two decades, and yes, he gives the individual discussions and writes the hot sheet information, which I read very carefully and make copies to distribute. Mike Scott, I don't know if you've spoken with him specifically. I bet you there's initiatives in his brain that he would love to explore or implement that, either haven't been for some because of some obstacles, but I'd say he'd be a go-to source to say what would be your avenue of delivery that's most effective and likely to occur, Have you spoken with him specifically about your interest in this?
We haven't, because, I mean, part of the reason for that is he's very closely tied to PCRI and to PACT, and, his time goes rather thin. I mean, one of the problems is he's one of the very few people who is out there talking about this sort of thing regularly. And, I would like to feel we could get a broader number of physicians who regularly were willing to talk about this sort of thing. I know that can be seen by some as a distraction from their major occupations, but I do think the messages that Dr. Moyad and others deliver are not as widely available as perhaps they might be. I mean, in other words, you can find them, but they aren't delivered with the same degree of, shall we say, fervor as information about, for example, even HIFU or radical or robotic prostatectomy by the medical community. And some years ago, we worked with Dr. Moyad and with many of the prostate cancer advocacy groups to produce a basic brochure about the management of advanced prostate cancer for patients. And literally tens of thousands of that booklet were distributed with funding from one of the drug companies. I don't think that's been replicated in years, despite the fact that we've had new advances in therapy. And those booklets very definitely did include information about diet and exercise, very specifically.
It seems to me as if the best channel we currently have is through the network of support groups and US2 and all of the others, where the support group leaders and facilitators get the information out. And also, this is different from most physician-related things in that there can be and should be a two-way dialogue, or, as Dr. Schellemer was saying before, a multi-peer-to-peer dialogue where goals are set in the monthly support group meetings or pledges are made and support is given on an ongoing basis that oftentimes a physician can't really do. It's emotional support as well as quasi-medical support. So that seems to me the best available channel for getting this information out. I know also from experience that on the subject of diet, there is so much bogus information out there. It falls to the support group leader to not just say this has been debunked, but also to provide the resources so that if someone's mother-in-law's cousin says, "Have you tried whatever it is?" to find out, is this worthwhile pseudoscience, or might there be something to it, or to investigate on their own. I've had some success with that, not as much as I would like.
Do you think we could in some way connect the idea of living well to fundraising? One of the things I'm wondering about is whether there would be some way to actually set one's own exercise goals and dietary goals and tie it to raising money to support the Prostate Cancer Foundation or Movember or one of the organizations that's very specifically into fundraising for research into prostate cancer. In other words, one is giving the individual patient a target beyond just losing 5 pounds or whatever, but actually saying to them, why not use this as a way to raise money as well by getting your friends to make donations if you hit those goals?
Well, I guess that's an extension of a 5K run or a whatever. Yeah, it's just more substance to it. It's ongoing rather than just a day at the races. Maybe zero or that runs these and other groups that run these national month by month marathons or 5Ks, not marathons, short races from city to city to city, would have interest in maybe putting that in their portfolio. It's an interesting thought.
It is. I think a lot of people would respond to that.
Yeah, because I mean, men in particular like a challenge. I mean, they like to feel that they're accomplishing something. I mean, women too, but you know, we're all trained as males from an early age to compete, and you know, try and win at something. And I mean, you know, to my mind, for many men, you know, losing 10 pounds is winning at something. And if it's set up the right way, this could be a quite a powerful way, because we could associate it with the relevant material when one signed up for the program. I'm increasingly sort of driven by this idea that it's not just the treatment for prostate cancer that is the biggest of the problems. It's the consequences of treatment and the effects that those can have on patients and on family members, way beyond whether they've got rid of the cancer or whether they're on active surveillance. I mean, clearly, if you're a patient who's at risk for metastatic disease, you're in a whole other realm of importance. But we can deal with many of those men as well. I mean, the number of men who have the truly aggressive forms of prostate cancer that are going to become debilitating within 3 to 5 years is a much smaller number than the 100 to 200,000 men who get diagnosed each year and who should still be able to live with a high quality of life. And I worry that we don't care for those men enough.
Certainly, if men can be motivated to grow their mustaches for 30 days in November, you'd think they could be motivated to take off an inch or an inch and a half around their waistlines, or take off 10 pounds or 12 pounds. I like your idea, Mike.
Well, I think at this point what I'd like to do is hand it back to Priya and see what sort of questions we've got out there from the audience we've got online, and see if we can, maybe they can stimulate us as well. Priya, you want to take it from here for a little while?
Thank you, Mike. We have some questions coming in. And listeners, if you have a question for our panel, please press 1 on your keypads and let us know, and we can bring you on air to ask your questions. Doctor, we have like quite a few questions that have come up on HIFU and focal therapy as of now. That's what I'm seeing. Maybe you can just comment on what you think the future of HIFU or focal therapy is for prostate cancer, and whether would you recommend HIFU ablation? That's what the questions are usually pertaining to.
Yeah, well, those are both tough questions, in sense that they're interesting ideas and new technology, and interesting ideas and new technology are always attractive because they are trying to clearly improve on the current state of the art, both with regard to effectiveness and reducing side effects, and so an effort to better treatment with fewer consequences of treatment. First, I'll take focal therapy. It's attractive because it's used with other cancers, specifically breast cancer, although there are not exact parallels, but it's lumpectomy is on everybody's vocabulary with regard to breast cancer, and why not use that same concept for prostate cancer? Well, there are a number of reasons why it's not in parallel. I cannot state that it won't be in the future a viable way of treating prostate cancer. I won't in any way say it's inappropriate, but I can say that at today and to the extent of today's knowledge, the ability to image the area of abnormality accurately enough and to be assured that other areas of the prostate are not involved with cancer is limited enough so as to say it's still in very investigational, and while there's interest, it's not, we'll say, standard or mainline therapy. With regard to HIFU.
And I'd like to interject. HIFU
is
an acronym for.
I welcome that, please, yes.
High intensity focused ultrasound for the many men who may never have heard of it or don't know what it stands for. But please go on, doctor.
Yes, yeah. So it is a way of focusing, again, through ultrasound beam energy into the prostate to destroy prostate tissue and prostate cancer. It is FDA approved for destruction of prostate tissue, not specifically for prostate cancer. So I think, at least in the U.S., it's important to recognize that it may not be covered by third-party carriers' insurance. But that aside, again, the experience with it is relatively small and short vis-a-vis the other therapies, the traditional therapies of surgery and external beam radiation. It may in the future be mainline therapy, but currently it's delivered in very select areas with individuals who've had a lot of experience. And there are some side effects dependent upon the operator's experience. Again, it's not at the center of therapies. It's at the margins because of, one, it's questions with regard to durability, side effects, and I'll say less than long-term knowledge base about outcomes. And I welcome Paul and Tony's thoughts because I'm sure they have heard the question many times, and I'd like to hear what they say in response to those questions.
All I have is anecdotes and what I've read in outcomes of clinical trials and so forth, and I know personally one man who has had HIFU and swears he has very good results from it. His cancer was Gleason 6, 3+3, and of course, as we all know, he may well have had very good results had he not done anything at all. I also know two men who had HIFU done and were quite dissatisfied with the results because in both cases, further treatment was necessary, and they both felt that the investment in HIFU, which was to a great extent out of their own pocket, was just wasted, that it didn't do anything for them. So that's only anecdotal, of course, and sample size of 3 doesn't prove anything. I do remember when it was the coming thing, the people were excited about it, and then the early results from early clinical trials were quite disappointing. And then with the next wave of results, things were less disappointing, but it didn't seem to be that it was on its way to becoming a viable therapy anytime soon. That was my subjective impression. Tony, how about you?
I've known a few people that have, gone down to Puerto Vallarta or outside of the country, paying $25,000 and having the procedure done. But you're right. The first thing that comes on into mind is, if we're taking these Gleason 6 guys now, the new standard of care for Gleason 6 guys these days is to watch, active surveillance. And that is kind of the general direction that we saw a lot of patients that were getting HIFU were all Gleason 6 guys that probably could have done well not treating it at all.
Right.
And so we really don't have a lot of data on HIFU. I'm one of those people who likes to see a quality level 1 trial. But right now at this particular time and date, focal ablation is just something with which can be done, but we don't have good results in paper to say this is a good idea or a bad idea for a particular patient.
I would, if I may, just comment. One of the things that worries me about treatments like HIFU and focal therapy, which are often given to patients who are low risk or favorable intermediate risk, is whether we're asking the right question at all.
Right.
Many of the patients who actually go for those treatments have a psychological problem with their disease as much as they have a medical problem. In other words, they simply aren't capable of watching it for 5 or 10 years, even if that was possible. And my question, therefore, is whether if one really wants to know whether these treatments are, quote, effective, unquote, it is their effectiveness in actually relieving these patients of their concerns while simultaneously actually, you know, removing the problem by lowering the PSA level. I don't think we've even really thought about that in this way at all as yet, and I'm not even convinced that it's the right thing to do, but certainly trials that address that issue might be more useful than trials which were designed to show whether these types of therapies are effective at 10 years or 15 years, which has been the traditional standard of the trials that have been done, usually simply as large registries rather than actual clinical trials. Although obviously with the data cut that came from the Stampede trial, we do now have that sort of data for active surveillance compared to surgery and radiation therapy. So we are starting to make progress in that direction. So perhaps we should ask Priya if she's got another couple of questions.
Yes, the next question is, I think we have been discussing a lot about exercise and nutrition and diet. So the question is, I have COPD and get out of breath with very little effort. I also have stage 4 prostate cancer. What exercises can I do to keep from getting breathless?
This is a urologist speaking, and I will have to beg ignorance on any useful information. That's a pulmonologist, I'll say, database to explore. There certainly are. I live in a retirement community where there are a lot of folks on oxygen and who are using walkers, and they go to the exercise room and do what they can under the direction of a specific physician's instruction, and that's the best I can offer. It's not nothing is possible, but it's a carefully supervised regimen based on the disease process the patient has.
Yeah, this is a question I've come across before. I mean, not this one very specifically, but questions like this. And the standard thing I always say to patients is, you really need to go and talk to a pulmonologist about this. And he needs ideally to be sending you to an exercise therapist who is expert in this and can give you very specific exercises that can help you to, you know, optimize the quality of your lung function without overstressing it. There are certainly are things that can be done. I'm not a doctor, and so I can't really tell you what they should be. But the really important thing here is to go and get expert advice from a pulmonologist and from an exercise therapist who really knows what they're talking about in this area. Priya, we have another question.
Thank you, Mike. Yeah, yes. So we have Richard Watson listening in, and he has actually sent in a couple of comments on our website. He says that that it is much more difficult to get patients buy-in for lifestyle interventions for reasons that have been mentioned so far. And he wants to ask if support groups can supposedly be helpful. Why aren't support groups also exercise clubs? And so maybe you can comment on that, doctor, in the panel, please.
Well, I'm going to pass it on to Tony and Paul.
I've actually got a question about that. I've wondered before whether some of the really large support groups, like, for example, the one in the San Diego area, have actually tried some of this, because it does seem to me that you could get a subset of the members of large support groups who did actually all join the same gym or group of gyms, and who, you know, worked out with the trainers at those gyms how to put together exercise services that were very specific to their needs. And I'm just curious whether anybody's heard anything like that.
We've had some success in my support group with small groups of men forming, mutual support things where they'll provide transportation to the gym and encouragement at the gym, or even just become tennis partners. And it's as much a social thing as it is anything else. But what tipped the scale just a little bit towards action was repeated mentions in the support group of, if you can get yourself to the gym, if you can get yourself exercising, you're going to have a better life. So it happens. It's rare. I wish it weren't so rare.
Are the specific things that you found, I mean, other than just mentioning it, that help to motivate people? I mean, in other words, the impression I get, Paul, is that an important aspect of this is the volunteers who are then prepared to provide that support in terms of the transport to the gym or being there to play tennis or whatever. I mean, in other words, you need that core of people who are going to take it on themselves to help others.
With the support group that I'm involved in, it is definitely, I'm a facilitator, and so I can see, Jim and Mike, you both, you're interested in tennis and you live kind of close to each other, and I happen to know where they each live. Or I can say, do you want to think about this? And I could put ideas in people's minds. But I don't compel, I just suggest. And sometimes it sparks and sometimes it doesn't. I'm not sure if that answered your question.
Yeah, one of the problems is I think it's extremely difficult to really push people to exercise. You have to entice them to it in
exactly.
Some way, shape, or form.
Right. And I've found that if I start to push, I alienate people. So
right.
I suggest, I put out a menu and say, up to you, with no shame if they don't pick it up and choose something.
We have one more question
Tony?
Now, Mike.
Go ahead, Priya.
I would like to hear Tony's comments on this before we move on.
Tony, any thoughts?
Not over and above what's already been said. I think that the support groups are a great spot to do it. Like I said, every year I have at least one group meeting which is dedicated just to anti-cancer diet and healthy lifestyle stuff. But I think that that is an excellent role for the peer support groups out there to always make sure that they talk about this in the group so that people are going to ask questions. They're just simply going to ask questions as it is. One of the most common questions I get from the person who's new to prostate cancer is, should I be changing my diet?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's a very common response to come back on over, like I had mentioned earlier. Absolutely, it's a good idea to always do something healthier. And I'm not going to discourage you from doing that.
Okay, Priya, I think we have time for one more question.
Yes, the question is, we're moving away from exercise and diet right now, and the question is, what are the diagnostic measurements used to stop ADT after an appropriate course?
As I hear the question, what are the diagnostic parameters that allow ADT cessation? And there are a number of compartments to discuss in answers to that question. So is the ADT being given as adjuvant neoadjuvant adjuvant treatment in conjunction with radiation therapy as primary treatment. There is a span between 6 months and 36 months of ADT based on the virulence of the cancer, namely the Gleason score, the clinical stage, and the PSA response. And so there's quite a variability between that 6 and 36 month and their ongoing clinical trials, thankfully, that are defining more clearly the minimal amount of time to get the maximal benefit from androgen deprivation therapy. Then there's the question if ADT is being given for patients who have what's called biochemical recurrence after primary therapy, and there's an issue is undeclared as to when actually to start it, at what PSA level, and once it started, when to stop it when the PSA becomes undetectable. It's called intermittent androgen deprivation therapy, and you could find more than three or four different programs as to how long you should continue it until the PSA or after the PSA becomes undetectable, and I'll just give a span of between 4 and 7 months. And then there's finally, if you have metastatic disease, the ADT is being delivered to control metastatic disease. The general thought process now is to continue it indefinitely, although there are some small windows. If there's very minimal metastatic disease and the ADT is causing a lot of symptoms, that intermittent therapy protocol might be implemented. So it's not a one-answer question, and there are different opinions, and there are clinical trials to support some of those opinions.
So, Paul, I am aware of some patients who were on long-term continuous ADT, had a effectively zero PSA for years, and who then stopped and appear to have been cured. I mean, in other words, they've been then not on ADT for years afterwards. It's a small number of patients, and I don't know of any diagnostic criteria that actually say that anybody is a good candidate for this. But I'm just curious whether you've come across that case studies
like
that.
The question would be, what is their testosterone level? If you've been on ADT, you're in your late 60s, and you've been on ADT for 5 years, the likelihood of your testosterone recovery is probably very low. And so they may be still on ADT, even though they're not receiving shots. So if their testosterone is castrate and they haven't had any shots for 3 years, they're still castrate and effectively on ADT. I'm sure there are a small percentage of patients in whom the T will rise to normal levels and the disease does not recur. That I will say that probably don't have a lot of information on that, but I'm sure it occurs. There are some patients' cancers that are exquisitely sensitive, but we really don't know how to compartmentalize those yet. So that would be my thought process on that question.
Okay, well, I think we've covered a lot of ground this evening, and I really appreciate everybody's help and support with that, and I thank the audience for their questions. Priya, would you like to conclude the program at this point?
Yeah, thank you very much, Mike. Dr. Shellhammer, thank you again for joining us today and sharing so much information with us. Tony and Paul, thank you so much for your participation, and this talk will be available on CureTalk's website. Please visit curetalks.com for details of all our upcoming talks. Thank you very much, everyone. Have a great evening.
Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Thank you, Tony, Mike. Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.